Hi, this is a podcast by IDEA, the Irish Development Education Association. It's about 25 minutes long. It's an interview between Matthias Fiedler from IDEA and Martin Kirk from Oxfam. The interview is about the Finding Frames research that was published by Oxfam in 2010 and discusses the implications of values and frames and public engagement with development for development educators.
What I wanted to do is I just wanted to talk a little bit about what happened since the frames document was published in January, and then go through a few questions with you.
Yeah? Yes.
So if you wouldn't mind, the frames document has been published at the beginning of 2011, and in the introduction it says that this is envisaged as the first stage of a much longer process.
Yeah? Yes.
And if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit, I know that you've been on the road a lot and there was a lot of requests. If you wouldn't mind just talking a little bit about what happened since the document was published in January.
Of course, yes. So, as you already said, the idea of the document is to, and it was an unusual document in this regard, because the appeal of it was an appeal to debate initially, not an appeal for people to particularly do anything differently, but to enter into the ideas debate, because this document, if anything, is about trying to encourage people to shift how they think about their roles in communications and campaigns and education work, not specifically to do X, Y, or Z differently. So what we did very specifically was craft the document in that way, and since then the response has been gratifyingly
overwhelming.
Discursive. Well, overwhelming is quite true, but discursive as well. People have actually responded to that call in a very, very gratifying way, and I'm sure the people who were at my presentation in Dublin will appreciate it.
Yeah.
There's an awful lot in there, and it's quite kind of intellectually challenging stuff and thick and dense stuff at points, and it's very difficult to communicate in sound bites and all that sort of thing. And so the way that people have responded has been particularly gratifying for that regard, because one of the things we were trying to shift in some of specifically campaigners' thinkings was that things are always obvious and easy, and the business of bringing about change is open to anybody to just have a go at, and expertise is not something that's valued very highly. So people have been thirsty, it seems, for some thoughts at this depth. And it's not just me that's been on the road. Andrew Darnton, my co-author, and Tom Crompton from WWF, who wrote one of the initial papers that stimulated all this, called Common Cause, has also been out and about and doing an awful lot of talking. The specific strands of work that have been stimulated and are ongoing, there's a lot within Oxfam. So Oxfam has a cross-divisional organization that's looking at all of its forward public-facing work in the UK, so our 700 shops, all of our fundraising work, all of our campaigning work.
Is that as a direct effect of the discussion that you started?
Yes,
or,
yeah. Yes, very much. Mm-hmm. It was ongoing before the report launched, because the development of the report, we had a bit of a head start, obviously. But
sure.
But yes, it definitely is a result of this report and the debate it stimulated. And I think to put words or to quote our fundraising director, our trading director, this was a real wake up call for Oxfam to show that. So, language and communications and campaigning has an awful lot more to it than we sometimes give it credit for. So the complexity of language is something that has really shocked Oxfam into a little bit of a reconsidering its own role. And now we have a whole track of activity that's going to culminate in a proposal for a whole multi-year corporate strategy in September that should affect our shop work, our fundraising work, our campaigning work. So the whole Oxfam face in the UK is going through a review because of this. Mm-hmm. We've also been talking with the UK big UK agencies, the BOAGs, which is ActionAid, ChristianAid, CAFOD, Save the Children, and Oxfam. They have a grouping called BOAG, and they have been presented with these ideas. And there is, to be fair, there's a varying level of buy-in, but everybody has cleared the first hurdle, which is, yes, we're willing to explore. We are convinced enough by these ideas that we are willing to look into them together. Because that's the other big piece of learning from this work, is that no one organisation, certainly not a campaigning department within one organisation, but even one organisation is not does not have the weight to sort of take on this sort of agenda by itself. It has to be pan-sectoral, really. At the very least, all of the development, not all of, but the critical mass of development organisations, but ideally, it has to be the whole charity sector has to kind of pay heed and beyond. So we're not insensitive to the scale of the agenda we're trying to kick off here.
Yeah.
So the BOAGs are looking at it, but particularly from a fundraising perspective, because one of the areas where the challenge is most stark is with some of the fundraising practices that we engage in.
Yeah.
And some of the frames that fundraising uses are what the thinking would suggest are very problematic. So there's a big BOAG process going on. Within Oxfam, I'm going to take a step back for one sec, because I think of the development education implications. Within Oxfam, we've also started to implicate this all the thinking into our development education programs. And we have been, our head of youth and schools work, John Kentish, has been working with other agencies to develop a values-centric approach to engagement with schools.
Okay.
And that's go on, sorry.
No, we might get to that at the end, because I have a question around the implications for development education and where we see them at the end of the question. Could I just on the what will happen next? The document stated very clearly that this is about the general public in the UK.
Yeah.
And you've outlined the processes that are in place for kind of future engagement in that conversation in the UK. Are there any outside the UK? Are there any developments that you can?
Yes. So we've already started. I've been across, as you know, Matthew, to Brussels and Helsinki, there's the Concord stuff. Now, I haven't heard any follow-up from the time when I was out there speaking to the Concord guys. I don't know if they're going to pick it up and run with it. There were a couple of things that were suggested when I was there, but I haven't heard any feedback. But what has happened, there's as part of, because there are essentially two tracks of activity here. There's the work coming out from the development-specific side, which is the Finding Frames report and all that. But as I mentioned earlier, the Common Cause report that we wrote with WWF and Tom Crompton, has been speaking, is kind of the face of this debate for the environmental groups. And when I was out in Brussels, I had lunch with a group of the environmental agencies, and they are setting up a Common Cause working group to explore these ideas at the European level. So that's very helpful to see that happening. As I say, there was lots of warm indications that Concord might do something similar, but I've heard nothing more. We've also used it very much in our global campaigning agenda from Oxfam specifically. And people who are familiar with the thinking, if they look closely at some of our Grow campaign, they will see an awful lot of these ideas being put into practice. In the Grow campaign, especially moving away from all the old moral order frames into much more, it's coming at him as practical visionary type communications, but also taking a much more engagement approach to our movement building, rather than that didactic clicktivism type stuff, and much more what development educators would probably class as an educative approach to our campaigning.
And I mean, just on the document itself, I think it's a very good example of that the combination of quality input, but having it as an open, because the having it as an open document as well is probably an approach that we should use more often, because very often we produce all those reports and then they are read and then that's it.
I
think this report is a really, really good example of how you can actually stimulate a debate, and because it was set up like that from the very beginning.
But it does. I wouldn't underestimate the amount of legwork that goes into.
Yeah.
You can do that, and then if you sit back and wait for people to start talking about it, you'll be sorely disappointed. Usually, people are very busy. So,
Would you mind if we went into a few more specific questions around the discussion. And one of it is that I have heard now a few times from educators being voiced as a, I would almost say as a concern, that there is a danger in the document that communication peoples and campaigning peoples will run with this idea of changing the language, changing the message, but without really changing the content of the message, if you know what I mean. So it's replacing words, but not really the modes of an engagement with the public. So having it as a spinning exercise rather than and I'm sure you've heard that that concern on your travels.
I have, and it's one that I share. I do worry that people will take, you know, that old saying, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. That people will just see the top line communications advice in this and run with it, and that really will miss the point. And this is another reason why we spend so much time putting a big report together, and why we have put so much effort into going around and giving fairly lengthy and deep presentations, because we wanted to model through the way that we talked about it. We wanted to model the truth around the depth of the thinking. So if we tried to, you know, if we produced, so you know, it's an example of the communication style on its own. Because if we produced like a two-page checklist thing and sent that to everybody with no follow-up, that would have undermined the message of that communication structure or channel or tool would have undermined the message of the report. So we've specifically not, and although lots of people would be saying, can you just give me a two-page summary of that? We've specifically not done that. And it's kind of one of our ways of articulating that don't run too soon. This isn't about doing X, Y, and Z differently, as I said at the beginning. This is about challenging how you think about your own communication. And it does, for some people, it leads to areas of, you know, process of self-reflection. Certainly at an organizational level in Oxfam, it is leading to a process of corporate self-reflection.
And I think that's a key. That's a key aspect that you've stressed in both of the events I was. That that whole discussion. It's not something that is. It's not a step by step recipe. But it's also not a thing of or a call to the arms. Doing it now and doing everything at once. It's really a call to what you've just said.
Yes.
To enter into a self-reflective culture of thinking about what we do and how we can do it better.
I think that's right, Matthias. And the other, because the interesting thing to think about is why are we producing the things that we're producing? Nobody is forcing us into doing things that this report would suggest are damaging. So you have to ask yourselves why. You have to go to the root source of the problem, not just try to fix the symptom. We did some research on Oxfam's 2010 communications canon, and it very clearly said, you know, these are the frames you're using, they're not the good ones, they have moral order, and they're very problematic, and da-da-da. And now we could have stopped there and said, right, well, let's fix it. But one thing we haven't started yet, but the next thing we want to do is bring some of those linguistic experts in and analyze our internal conversations, because there is something that we are, something in us that is producing that outcome. And unless we understand what that is, we will not be able to change the outcome. So we can gloss over it, and we can change a few words, but exactly as you said, unless you change, in the terminology of the report, the deep frames, the surface frames will just get polluted with the same meanings over time anyway, and you won't actually change anything substantial.
Okay. The other big, in terms of process, the other big claim in the Frames document is that, and you've already mentioned it at the very beginning, that this is something that can't be done by one department, one NGO. It's about alliances. It's about cooperation. It's about doing it, working closer together, basically.
Yes.
Many of the actors in that field. do you have any examples or concrete concrete ideas. I don't know if there's already examples there, but concrete ideas of how such coordinated and working closer together activities could look like. If you look, for example, at education and campaigning, are there already examples where you would say this is probably an example of how we could start working?
Of kind of the mechanisms of collaboration, you mean?
Yes.
Right, yes. Well, there are loads of different models out there, and I think one of the truths is that they each get gets reinvented every time. So rather than point to a specific model, there are a couple of bits of advice that I think that we've tried to do that I think some things we've learned from us that have worked better. And because of the nature of this debate, I think the only reliable structure is a loose one. You cannot force people into this at all. And if people are unwilling to engage into the debate, leave them alone. Mm-hmm. You absolutely need people to accept the argument and think about it. And if they're not the sort of people who are going to do that, then don't worry about it. There are always more people to do it. So I would say take a loose approach to it. The phrase that we've used is basically follow the energy. Mm-hmm. Follow the energy of the people who seem interested and who react well. Engage more with them, pick up the phone with them, get yourselves in rooms with them, and find the coalitions of the interested. I'm confident, especially with development educators, that you will not find those people in short supply. This seems to resonate very well with development educators because an awful lot of it comes from education type thinking. So don't sweat about getting everybody that you think is really important into the room. You need to do a rough kind of power analysis of who you think the critical players are, but be encouraging, and if people aren't prepared, then don't try to force it because it won't work.
And sometimes it's better to invest the energy in forging alliances rather than convincing people who will be hard to,
exactly.
to convince anyway. Yeah.
Exactly. And then don't. You've got to be very generous with this stuff. Nobody has all the answers on it. So some people might be a couple of steps further down the road than others, but there's no guru. There's no, there's nobody who people should follow. Particularly, this is about embracing ideas, not about adopting one person's model. So you have, in a way, turn your own knowledge about how to build education how to build learning in an educational environment into your models for how you talk this stuff through. So take a development education approach with each other to it, if you see what I mean. Or an educational approach with each other. And let people take it in their own way. Don't try to be prescriptive with it. Don't try to set up too rigid a structure around it. Working groups are fine, but don't try to set up a coalition or an alliance and have a strict TOR around it. Don't encase it in too much process.
Because it prevents people from being really reflective and honest in those reflections of what their contribution can be as well.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't want people to be on this in this little trendy thing this year and in another one next year. It's not a fashion. It's learning. It's education. It's not fashion. So the next communications book will come along next year, but you want people to still be thinking in terms of the depth of their language choice. Moving on.
Okay. In a way, you've already touched on or answered some of the questions that I was going to ask you in terms of the role of development education in that. But if you wouldn't mind saying a little bit more about what I interrupted you at the very beginning when you were kind of outlining what development education in Oxfam is going to do. And you are probably aware of the fact that in the education sector, the whole question around values education is a difficult one in a way, because values education has attracted a lot of criticism in terms of being a type of education that basically decides on a set of values and then teaches about them.
Yeah. Be more like me sort of education.
Yes. And that was one of the biggest values education at some stage in the history of development education. Was quite a fashionable thing, and then it went out of fashion because it didn't have that openness that development educators, or it didn't provide that open learning space that development educators often see as very important.
And I think that betrays... that sort of criticism betrays a basic misunderstanding of the way that language and human thought works, because to suggest that anything you do is not does not project a values message is, as I say, to misunderstand. You cannot engage in communication without projecting values. So you either do it with your eyes open or you do it with your eyes closed, and that's entirely up to you. So the idea that we're not doing values education all the time is incorrect assertion. If people accept that, and I think the evidence is overwhelming on that, I mean, I can't imagine a single person I've ever spoken to in academia would blink at that statement for a second. So if you accept that, then you just have to think, you have to start thinking about how you do it honestly and transparently, and not in a way that is genuinely Machiavellian. This is where we have a lot to learn from development educators, because
it goes back to the Freire argument, basically, even though he's probably a little bit overused in development education, but he has this very strong claim that you can't teach if you're not open about your values and your
right.
and the kind of assumptions that you have and your political beliefs. So it's not a problem to have those, and the only problem would be if you hide them and assume a kind of a neutral position.
Exactly.
You will never be a neutral person.
Exactly.
And it's better to have it openly out there and teaching about it, and then let people engage with it rather than hiding it and assuming there's no neutral position.
Precisely right. Precisely right. So and the beauty of this. That sort of understanding is that it allows for an incredible scope for what you're teaching about, you know, the issues level, and what it suggests that is you need to do is just encourage recognition of the fact that the reasons these things are important is because of the values that they embody. So the reason you talk about why it's important for people to have water or rainfall patterns or it's because we care for the well-being of other people.
Mm.
And it's no more social engineering-y than that. You know, saying, I think it's important for you to know this stuff because I believe it is important to care for other people. That is a value statement writ large. So the role of development education, I think, is a critical one. Now, we're in a particular situation here in England that is not shared, even in Scotland and Wales, and I'm sure not in Ireland, although I don't know that for sure, but the current government is basically ripping up the national curriculum and discarding all the things that we relied on in terms of global citizenship education to get our messages into schools. So we are having to think through our response to that, and the response that we're trying to stimulate is a values-based response, is a response that says, well, whether you're the Red Cross or you're the Animal Sanctuary or the WWF or Oxfam or whatever your cause, whatever your issue cause, will bind you with the values that they represent. It's those caring, benevolent, universalist values. So let's come together on that agenda.
So it's again the cross-sectoral approach, where it's not just a global justice agenda, but it's a general justice agenda.
It's a values agenda. And schools are very receptive to this, because if there's one thing they hate, it's the sense that the charities are competing for their children's time. And anything that gives the impression that we are collaborating and that we are working together goes down well as an opening gambit with schools. But it also recognises the truth of the fact. You know, if you had five schools in an area and one of them really went with Oxfam and one of them really went with NSPCC and one of them really went with Barnardo's and one of them went with the Donkey Sanctuary, the values agenda would say that's fine. That's no problem at all, because the really important thing is to stimulate and activate and strengthen those caring values. and it frees us up from feeling the need to compete with each other. There are more than enough schools. The demand for us, for our services, is far greater than the supply still. So we are in the luxurious position of not really needing to compete, and if we can find an agenda that binds us and that is mutually supportive. So that's where I think we're trying to move some of the development education debates into that sort of area.
Okay,
and yes.
Yeah. That brings me to my final question, and that is how for that to happen. I don't know how much you're aware of all the processes that are going on in development education at the moment and thinking, but what do you think needs to change in the development education sector for that process that you've just described to happen?
You're right. I mean, I'm not in the best position to pick apart the intricacies of it. I think the development education sector, from what I know of it, is still quite atomized, certainly in England and Wales. I mean, because there are so many schools out there, it's atomized both at the level of individual organizations, but also at the level within organizations. So, for example, within Oxfam, our fundraisers would love nothing better than to get into schools and do their fundraising. Well, hopefully in the Values Agenda can help explain to them the benefit to everybody of not taking that just focus on your job and your task approach. So I think there's a job to be done to reconcile the fundraising development education debate, which I know has been raging for many, many years, and lots of agencies, you know, some agencies have gone one way, others have gone another way. I would say this potentially opens up a different area of debate within which those two polar opposites, in a way, of approaches in schools can come together a little bit. But I would also say so there's atomization across fundraising campaigning departments, but also between organizations. There needs to be much more coming together, as I say, and stop. The basic appeal here is towards collaboration. You've got to live the values and the frames yourself in order to project them properly. So you have to ask yourselves, are you collaborating to the maximum?
Collaboration always means for each of the sides to move.
Yeah.
And that's one of the messages of that document, isn't it? That
yes.
Everybody has to move from the position they're in at the moment.
They do, but they first of all need to have some thinking time.
Yeah.
So don't ask people to move too quickly.
Okay.
Give people the space to think and question and be defensive. And you know, I was at an event last night with the Institute of Fundraisers and a set of directors from various different organizations presenting this thinking. And these are directors. These are the people who the buck rests with in terms of the fundraising income. And there were some quite defensive reactions from them, but ultimately we got to the point where they were like, this is about the bigger picture. This is about all of it, you know, growing the pie, whatever you want to call it, but it is about the bigger picture. But you have to give people the space to in order to reach that conclusion themselves and let them ask you the complicated, difficult questions and let them challenge you and arrive at it for themselves.
Okay, and that space is exactly what the summer school for which we have recorded this interview should provide. And
excellent.
I'm sure that the interview will provide a very good input into our discussions.
Well, I'm delighted to be able to input. So thank you very much, Matthias.
Thank you. And I'll stop the recording.